went back to the studies after a few years in the mission field, came back to catch up a little bit on studies. You know, it's a great thing to be a student missionary because it kind of refocuses you in life. And you get to see what's really important. Well, my wife and I went after we finished nursing and the aviation studies, went overseas for a few years and realized I had to come back for some more. Then went overseas again and had to come back for some more. And we kept coming and bouncing back and forth, preparing always for a different aspect of mission service. And I went to a public university, and I was extremely pleased for the first time in my life to be at a university that made you seem so different than everybody else. If you're a mature Christian, it's a great advantage to be different than everybody else. If you're young and trying to form your initial friendships, it's kind of dangerous because at that age, you're embarrassed to be different. But it was great. I'd walk in and people would say, "Are you a Christian or something?" You know, somehow there's just something about you. And they would want to know what you believe. And one day the teacher of the class raised his hand and said, "Have a good weekend and get real drunk." I said, "Excuse me, can I have a question?"
"Yes."
I said, "Don't you believe in education?" "Yes." And I said, "Don't you believe that getting drunk ruins your brain?" "Yes." "So how come you're encouraging us to all get drunk?" He hung his head and said, "Okay then, don't get drunk." And a lot of kids came to see me afterward and said, "Hey, what do you do on the weekends? You know, we just go party." I said, "Well, there's a lot of good things to do on the weekends." And it was a good way to develop contacts. But at that university, I gave every teacher, when I got done, I gave them a really beautiful copy, the most expensive copy I could bind as a professional, written in gold, of The Great Controversy. And every one of them got one. All the way through those 2 years I was going, every single class, every single teacher got a copy of Great Controversy. And somebody who's an academician who loves books won't throw a nice book away. If you give them a paperback book, it'll go in the trash. But if you give them a book that is really nicely bound, I don't care if it's something they don't agree with, they will put it on the shelf. You don't throw nice books away, do you? Because you keep it as a reference. And so I gave every teacher one of those books. But I remember when one of my assignments in one of my classes, I had to take world religion from somebody who had a PhD in world religion and didn't even believe in God. And it was a difficult class to take because we were studying all the world religions and they were all the same. They're just a way to get along in life. And I had to read a book in world history by an author that Machiavelli. And the book was called The Prince. And this little tiny book is a book on politics. And it's certainly not written from a Christian point of view. It was about what decision, if you were a prince of a country, what do you have to do to survive and get ahead and step on everybody else and get world dominance? And I had to read it for an assignment. I read the book, and it certainly was exactly the opposite of what the Christian attitude was. I mean, here's where you fight your enemies. Here's where you betray your friends. You do whatever you have to get on top. That was a summary of the book. What do you have to do to get on top? But one thing I was right in that book. One thing it said, and it was absolutely certain, and it applies to us in a Christian life. You have to make a decision what side you're on. You got to choose sides. You can't play neutral. People who play neutral get themselves in hot water, and eventually they run over by both sides. If there's a war, don't stay in the middle. Choose sides while you still got a chance to choose sides. Because if you're right in the middle, both sides will get you. And that's true in a Christian life, isn't it? You can't play neutral. Neutral is the worst position that anybody can have. Decide what side you're on. The Bible made that clear when it said be hot or cold, but don't be lukewarm. And today, we find in God's church that lukewarm is the position of a great majority of us. It's getting less and less that way. I'm very thrilled. Are you finding a polarization happening? It's happening all around us. People are making decisions. We're getting off the fence, and it's thrilling to see the Holy Spirit do that. We're still a lot of us that haven't made the decision yet. But getting off the fence is what's necessary to decide. And even back as far as Joshua's time, and you all know the verse, but Joshua 24:14, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth. and put away the gods which your father served on the other side of the flood in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. And verse 15, and if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose ye this day whom ye will serve, whether the gods of your fathers that they served on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Make a decision. Are you going to serve those gods? Or those gods? Or are you going to serve the Lord? But whatever you do, make a decision. I can imagine how hard it would be if you were on a ship, and the ship was going down, and there was only so many seats available. And you had to choose which of your family was going to be saved. If you're the captain of a ship, as a captain of an airplane, I fly over ocean a lot. And I have my life raft, and I have life jackets for everybody. But what would happen if you had to choose who could be saved and who couldn't? Now, in emergencies and disasters, physicians and nurses have to do what they call triage. And they have to choose who they possibly think would profit from medical care, and those who probably are too far gone and can't help it anyway, put them aside. They'll have to go on, because we can only invest the time we have on those that have hope. Hard decisions. Not pleasant decisions. And if you have to choose between a child and a mother, between this and that, or a friend of mine in Brazil, in Manaus, he's from South Africa. And then he grew up, he spent a lot of time in Angola. He used to fly a lot. He owns his own airline in Manaus. And he told me, when he used to fly in the war there in Angola, he used to have to go into a village just as the enemy was coming in, and he'd have to choose how many children he could squeeze on his airplane and get them out of there before the enemy came, because when the enemy came in, it killed everybody. And he said, and I would squeeze as many children. One more baby, one more little child, one little girl, get them in there, bang, me, take off just before the enemy swept through there. And when they came back, there was nobody alive. Decisions, hard decisions. And yet, the more we get to know God, the more we know about His character, the less fear you have about trusting Him with your future. Isn't that right? Thank you. Thank you for that feedback. God can be trusted. He loves you so much that if He would just give Him the chance to have total control of your life, He has a beautiful plan. He knows His thoughts about you, plus for good and not for evil. He knows what He wants for you. And we run around distrustful of Him. I was sitting in Bolivia recently at the university, and I was sleeping in a guest room, but one of the professors gave me a room, and the wall was full of books, and they were all in Spanish, and I was just looking through them. Oh, one in English. She doesn't know English. I wonder why she has that there. Huh. Pulled it off the shelf. Been out of print for about 40 years. It's about trusting God. So I started reading, and I discovered that, I mean, I knew this, but it was pointed out clearly to me, that the reason we distrust each other, why we have problems between friends, family, between bosses, employees, between countries, why Bush and Saddam Hussein don't hang out together, things like that. Why all this distrust? Because if we can't trust God, how can we trust each other? I mean, if the supreme being of the universe can't be trusted, no wonder we don't trust each other. Isn't that right? I mean, you destroy the whole foundation of trust. And that's what it's all about. Can you trust God? Can God be trusted? That's really what it's all about. And therefore, we've come to a time when we have to make a decision. Now, of course, one can push it off. One can wait until the decision is made for you. If the ship is going down and you're sitting there waiting around to see if you want to do this or do that or who's going to get on, you can wait until it's too late and there's no more seats. Or you can stand in line and see if there's going to be a seat. Or you can jump and start helping people getting on. You might get on, you might not get on. But the main thing is, you can wait until there's no decisions to be made and it's too late. The only problem is, the default, you know what default means, the one that's automatic, the decision is, you're not going to be on board. That's the default. To be on board, you have to make a decision. And that's why Joshua led God's people and said, choose ye this day whom you're going to serve. He was an old man already, and he was getting ready to pass on. And there weren't any other Joshuas like him standing in line. And therefore, he called the people to a decision. Now, what is the benefit of making a solid decision? Defining what side you're on has really good benefits. It means that your future decisions align themselves with the decision you just made, instead of always having to decide every time you make a decision. In aviation, we have like 10 commandments. And you need to adopt what decision you're going to make in an emergency before the emergency happens. You don't say, well, when an emergency happens, I'll try to decide what I have to do. For example, I have 8 hours of fuel on the airplane. The one that I fly, the twin-engine plane that I fly all the way down to South America and back to the States and so on. I fly to Illinois, Miami, Miami, Puerto Rico, South America, usually Venezuela or Guyana. Then I go to Brazil, then I go to Bolivia, then I go to Peru, or Argentina, and come all the way back again. It's a long flight. But in all those flights, I have a little instrument that's called a storm scope. And with a storm scope, I can see the lightning strikes up to 150 miles away, and I can start dodging as I go along, where there's lightning strikes or thunder, you know, thunderhead activity, so you can start avoiding it. But I have a decision already made. What happens if I run low on fuel? Now, I always leave an hour reserve of fuel. I never fly a flight plan more than 7 hours. But that extra hour of fuel is there for an emergency. And if you need it, how far will I go? Well, legally, if it's daytime and if it's not an instrument flight plan or if it's not an instrument conditions, you can always have, you must have at least half an hour reserve in the tanks of the airplane. If it's instrument conditions with bad weather, you need to have enough to go to an alternate plus 45 minutes circling. And occasionally, even that's not enough. And you have airplanes declaring emergencies. And in Miami, they just stack up one on top of the other during an emergency like this. And then the bottom one lands, and then they all scoot down 1,000 feet. And then the other one lands, and they all scoot down. And the newest airplane goes to the top of the stack. And so if you come in and land, and you miss the runway, and you can't see it, you go to the top of the stack and start your way down again. It's not very pleasant. And of course, if you're near the top of the stack and you have 45 minutes reserve and it takes 50 minutes to get down to land, you have to declare an emergency. That means that you take priority over all the other airplanes, and the other airplanes start declaring emergencies. I mean, it can become an emergency in itself. But you have to decide ahead of time, what if this happens, what I'm going to do? And what if that happens, what do I do? And once you make those decisions ahead of time, you don't wait till you're tired at the end of a long day, you've been flying day and a little bit of rest, and you're tired at the end of the day, and all of a sudden you have an emergency, you go, now what am I going to do? It's already been decided. You've decided ahead of time what you're going to do. And that's what heroes do in wars. Have you ever decided in your life, just as an illustration, what would happen if you went out one night and found somebody being assaulted by 3 or 4 or 5 people? Would you just drive on? Would you stop and get out? Would you go to their rescue? Would you get on the cell phone and behind the window of your car go, hello, please leave that person alone? You know? What would you do? Have you decided that? I mean, I read it in newspapers where people get killed and raped and other things right outside of a housing complex, and nobody comes out and does anything. There's everybody's looking out their window. You've heard of those, haven't you? What would you do? If you haven't thought about it, you ought to think about it, because one of these days, all of a sudden, you'll find yourself face to face with that. Well, let me ask you another question. What would you want somebody to do for you if you were in that position? If that was you getting assaulted, what would you do? Would you pray for somebody to please come and intervene? You'd be happy for somebody to step out and help you, wouldn't you? I read about a man who was walking along a little path, and he decided what he was going to do. He would intervene. And so he's walking along a little path, and he hears a rustling in the bushes, and he hears a lady screaming. And he knows somebody's getting assaulted, but it's dark. He doesn't know what to do, and he's scared because he's by himself. What if there's more than one person there? What if they attack him too? But he'd already made his decision. And so he ran into those bushes and intervened on behalf of that young lady. And the man ran. And after the man ran, the lady was kind of hiding in the bushes, half dressed. And as he was looking, she said, Daddy, is that you? He'd rescued his own daughter. He didn't know it was her. What if he'd have gone on by? Hard decisions like that, solid black and white decisions made ahead of time, will help you in the future. And if you decide what side you're on now, how are you going to react? You don't think about it twice. You just act. How would you like to be treated? Based on that, make your decision. When I was in Peru, and my car overheated, and I had a car full of computers, and I had a starter that was out of the car being rebuilt, and I had to be pushed everywhere, and I coasted in and came to a full stop right at the side of an old 1950-something bus from Martin Luther King's era. No wheels on it. You know, one of those round buses like you used to see on TV, little tiny windows on them. And everybody knew that was a center for drug trafficking, and my car pulled up right next to it. Frozen engine, no way to start the engine, overheated. And I'm in my suit. I quickly pulled off my suit and said, I'm going to try to look as innocuous as possible, but it's impossible. You know, sitting there like red meat hanging in front of a piranha. I put water in it. It all ran out. I realized it was running out through the freeze plug. And then they closed the stores, and I was by myself on the road. And then as I'm looking around, there's nobody with me. These men start to surround me with rocks. And I said, Lord, it's no greater love has any man than this, and to give up his life for not a computer. So you don't expect me to be able to give my life for computers, but at the same time, this is your assets. These are your computers. Brand new computers, right off the port, for our university, for our unions and our missions. And I said, I ask you to please protect your resources, but I'm not going to give my life for this. I'm going to step back, and I'm leaving. You'll have to protect them. And as I stepped back, I almost bumped into a man that was standing next to me. There wasn't anybody there a second ago. And the strange thing about this man is his face was so perfect that I forgot all about the assailants, and I just stared at his face and I said, I've never seen such a perfect face. I mean, on TV, yes. And as I was staring at his face, he said to me, your life is in danger, you have to leave. Those men, I know them, they just assaulted another bus full of people, and they want the equipment that's in your car. And I thought, how does this guy know about the equipment in my car? How does he know about those men? A nicely dressed man like this. He said, get in your car, I'm going to push. You can't push my car. I said, it took 3 men to get it going at the port. He said, get in your car, I'll push. I said, okay, but you won't be able to. And besides, the engine is frozen. I got in my car, but as I was getting out, I thought, what about the assailants? And they were all frozen, they weren't moving. They were just holding their rock like this. Strange. I got in my car, I said, I don't know what's going on. You know, when things really happen, you don't always think about what really is going on. I turned the key on, I said, this won't start, it's frozen. But when the car started moving, I said, well, at least he's strong, at least I know that. And it gained speed, and I let go of the clutch, and it started right up. So I quickly rolled down my window, and I called him over, and I said, here, I want to give you a tip. He said, no, I don't need your tip, I don't use money. I said, what do you mean you don't use money? Of course you use money, everybody uses money. I pulled out a couple of dollars. He goes, I don't need your tip. I don't need it. I said, I don't care. That's the courteous thing to do. I'm going to give it. Thank you very much. He said, go, go. Your life is in danger. So I pulled out, and as I pulled out and my engine started to overheat again, I pulled into a gas station a couple blocks down. Then it hit me who it was that had been there by my side. It wasn't but a few weeks later. I was coming in an all-night trip from North Peru, and the bus decided to just... There was problems in the center of town. There was some traffic jams. They would just leave us right there in the middle of the street. Everybody get off, grab your suitcases. This is as far as the bus goes. Shoot, I've been waiting to go to the bathroom. I needed to walk through the streets like this. And I thought, I'd been to a mission office where I helped to do the auditing and the counting system on the computer and so on. And so I said, well, I'm going to have to walk for several blocks, but I walked a couple of blocks, and it just got worse and worse, and I could hardly walk and see straight. So if I'd have just been on the street with regular clothes, there's always a corner you can take a leak on, but not like that. And if you'd been in the jungles, you got a tree, but not in the middle of dressed nicely. So I started asking, is there a public bathroom? Well, down a little alley over there. So I said, I don't want to walk down that little alley. But no choice, I kind of backed acting like I wasn't planning to go up the alley. Suddenly I ran up the alley, paid my 2 cents, ran into the public bathroom, and about the time I taxied into position and became helpless, I heard a scuffle outside. And this man with a red bandana, a young man, big guy, with a sword in his hand, ran in and he ran right toward me and he was going to run me through with it. And just about that time he got the sword right up to me, I was by myself in that bathroom. He looked up behind me, his mouth fell open, he put the sword down, he backed up, he kept his eyes on that, whatever he was looking at, he put the sword down and he went into the corner and tucked his head down like this. Man, I zipped up and I was out of there. The guy who I paid the 2 cents to get in, he didn't expect me to come out, he expected the other guy to come out with my briefcase. He was surprised. And I realized that same angel again probably showed up and scared the guy. And then a pastor friend of mine went to visit a young lady's parents who happened to get pregnant in the university, and her father, who was not an Adventist, said, "I'm going to kill that Adventist pastor when he comes." So when he came, all the neighbors looked out the door to see the bloodshed. And he had his machete with him. And he kept looking at the pastor's car and talking to the pastor, he had his machete. He didn't pull his machete out. Finally, he told the pastor, "Come back tomorrow." Came back the next day and he said, "Who is that big guy with you?" "What guy?" "That big muscle man with those big arms there." I had his arms and he was looking over the top of the car at me. I said, "I didn't come with anybody." "Well, you brought somebody because he had big shoulders like this and muscles." And you know what I realized? Everywhere we go, if you're on God's mission, you're accompanied. You got protection. So I go back to the original question. If you walk with angels, what are you going to do next time you see somebody needs your help and you have to risk yourself? Huh? If you believe you got protection, walk right into the thick of it. I made up my choice. I'm on my mind. I've made my choice. I'm not going to enjoy it necessarily, but I've already made my choice. If I see 10 guys assaulting a person, I'm going to walk right into them. Guys, split. Why? Because I know who I walk with. Now, if God doesn't want to show, if God orders the angel, "Don't show yourself," that's his problem, isn't it? If he wants me to get attacked, that's also his problem. But I'll tell you what would Jesus do if he saw somebody in need? He'd walk right up and people would split. Now, if you're walking with Jesus and walking with angels, perfect love casts out all fear. So, what about making decisions ahead of time? I ask you again, what side are you on? Christian Service, my favorite little book, page 237. God's special blessing accompanies the labors of men of action. And women of action, of course, too. Men who will not be swerved from the straight line of duty, but who with divine energy will inquire, "Who is on the Lord's side?" Interesting enough, not to stop there. Men who will not stop merely with inquiry, but who will demand that those who choose to identify themselves with the people of God will step forward and reveal unmistakably their allegiance to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. There were 5 frogs on the log. 4 frogs decided to jump off. How many frogs were left? Some of you answered correctly. 5. Why? Because there's a big difference between deciding and doing. You can decide all you want, but if it's not followed by action, no cuenta. You understood that, didn't you? Doesn't count. You have to act on your decision. If God's special blessing accompanies men and women of action, and if they stand up and inquire who is on the Lord's side, and then don't stop there, but say, if you are on the Lord's side, then identify yourself clearly and unmistakably which side you're on. When people look at your life, do they say, a totally committed individual to the Lord whose whole life is dedicated to serving and honoring God? Is that what they say of you? If they don't, something is wrong. It's not unmistakable, it's mistakable then. How you dress, how you act, what you talk about, what you view, what you read, what you listen to, is it unmistakably aligned with the King of Kings? And that is hard decisions we go through, what we watch and other things. Very hard. There was a father one time who had a young son came to him and said, "Daddy, we need your permission to watch a movie tonight." "Well, what kind of movie is it, son?" "Well, I want to bring my friends over, and it's something that's recommended recently. It's not something that lately came out, but it's a pretty good movie. It has a good plot." "Well, does it have any violence in it?" "Well, it has a little bit of action. Not very bad, you know, no graphic violence, but just a little bit." "What about the morality? Do they have any immorality?" "Well, it kind of insinuates, you know, that they go to bed together, but you don't see anything." "What about the language?" "Well, there's a few words, but, you know, we just won't listen to them." He said, "Bring all your friends over. Come tonight, I'll give you my decision tonight. And I'm going to have a special treat for you." "Ah, great." So he brought all his friends over. "Now, Daddy, what can we watch it tonight?" "Well, first let me give you some. I got something special for you." Big old thing full of big chocolate chip cookies. He said, "Before you eat the cookies, let me tell you what's in it. Big chips of German chocolate. The best. Then I bought this and that ingredient, all the stuff I could buy, the most expensive ingredients. And I baked them all together, and here they are for you." "Ah, Daddy, thank you. Before you eat them, let me tell you one more thing. All of those good things I put in it, only one more thing I haven't told you what's in it. There's a little bit of dog poop." "But don't worry about it, it's not very much, it's a little bit." "Daddy, come on, you know, no, true. I went outside and just dug a little and just crumbled it up." And so the kid said, "Why did you do that?" "Because a little bit doesn't hurt anything. You were telling me that a little bit of violence, a little bit of sex, a little bit of words, it's not anything. So a little bit of dog poop, what's the difference?" The kids did not eat the cookies, and the kids did not watch the movie. But don't we fool ourselves so many times like that? I had a friend of mine say, "Well, I just don't listen to all those bad words." "Well, then how come your vocabulary is getting worse every day?" Huh? Everything that goes in here stays there. And it takes a lot of work on reprogramming for God's part when it starts to erase it. And if you keep refeeding that, it keeps staying there. Fortunately, God is an expert at reprogramming our minds. And He can make that stuff, but it's always there. Except that God puts it further deeper and deeper, and pretty soon it drops out the back somewhere into the unconscious and your whole character. But it takes a long time. It takes a lot of work. It doesn't happen overnight. And so therefore, why would we reprogram our carnal state when supposedly we die with Christ and we're crucified with Christ, and yet at the same time we're feeding our old appetite and keeping the old man alive? But if I were to go to your home, to my home, in your absence or my absence, and somebody were to look on all the walls and look at everything that's there, what would you find? Would you find the world there? I went to visit a dentist's home as a kid. It was a friend of mine. I had somebody who was in practice with one of my family members, and he was a leader in the church, and we went there and everything. And years later, he continued to be a leader. And I know probably God led him through everything, but unfortunately, he forgot to take the Playboy magazines out of the bathroom when I went there. But that's not even the worst. The worst sometimes is the most subtle things. Sometimes it's the other magazines. I don't have anything necessarily bad, but that look okay. But that's filled with the world. And he continues. So God must have led him, because he continues to be a church leader and truly working in the church and doing a great job. So God must have led him move through a victory with that. Men are men, and women are women, and all of us are human. And we have to know that we have temptations. The Lord knows it very well. But that's His specialty. His specialty is taking out our heart of stone and putting in a heart of flesh. That's it. That's what He does good. When I work with people, I like putting them into places. I have about 40 volunteers. And I like finding out, what's your skills? What do you like to do? What's the best thing? Well, let's put you in the area of your strength. And that way they enjoy doing what they're doing. God does that. Do you know what God's specialty is? Changing hearts. Cleaning hearts. And all over recreation again. He loves taking marriages and giving them new spark of life. He loves taking people who are worn out and giving them. I think that must be the thrill God loves. Is taking somebody who everybody thinks is no good anymore and turning them into something beautiful. Choose this day whom you will serve. For me, this next few minutes wraps up my part of the camp meeting. It's been a blessing. But I made a call the other night, and a great majority of you came forward. But I want to ask you tonight, if your decision, or if you've made the decision since that call, if you didn't come forward, I want to ask if that's going to lead to action. The moment you say to the Lord, I place all of me, all my assets, everything on the line, they're all yours. God has a way of saying, prove it. What does that mean? What does it really mean to you when you choose sides? What if today Nazi Germany walked through the door and said, we don't want any more Seventh-day Adventists in this country. Choose you this day whom you're going to serve, because if you're going to be on our side, fine, or just line up outside and you're going straight to the prison camp. Some of them will say, oh, be careful, you know, this is probably not a time to decide. We can decide this later. A cardiac heart surgeon, an Argentine Adventist heart surgeon, works in Hinsdale. Well, he doesn't work at the hospital in Hinsdale. He works for the Catholic hospital. He's an Adventist, but he works on a heart team. He's a very committed Seventh-day Adventist and a missionary. He goes to work with great controversies every day, and he hands them out to everybody he meets on the elevator at the Catholic hospital. And he's evangelizing a whole heart team. But his wife told me, and when she was a little girl, they marched into their church and said, everybody throw down your Bibles and step on them. And many of them did. Except for one man, he refused to even consider it. And he wasn't even a church member. He'd been attending, he was considering baptism. And he refused to do that. Others just quickly left, and others kind of symbolically laid him down and walked out. This man just sat there and he held on to his Bible. And they went and focused on him. And he said, I will not lay down my Bible. It's God's word, and I will not step on it. So they took him outside and they threw him in a sewer pit. And when he tried to come close and try to reach the side, they hit his fingers with a hammer. So he let go. And then they got some pitchforks and they drowned him in a sewer pit. And they just let him float there. Eventually, she and her family had to sell their business and leave town because they couldn't be Seventh-day Adventists in that town and probably survive. I was just in this generation. I met another guy in Mexico. He showed me all the bullet holes in his leg. His dad had been a preacher. And he'd been shot at while they were preaching. And he said, my dad has a lot of scars on his back because one day we were preaching and out of the cathedral ran all these guys with machetes and cutlasses. And there was two pastors. I grabbed my father and I ran with him, but the other pastor, they caught him and they cut him into tiny pieces and delivered that in a gunny sack and put it in front of the church. This is what we do to Protestant pastors in our country. And they laid that, all that tiny pieces in a gunny sack in front of the church door. There's a cost attached to it. But you got to make a decision. There's a reward attached to it too. And right now, God is not in the business of going through the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages and going through 1,200 years of darkness. It's not His business right now. His business right now is to fill the whole earth with His glory and finish the work and come so He can come. There is no excuse right now for God's people to be going through the Dark Ages through ignorance. Right now, it's time to finish the work. It's time to sprint to the finish line. It's time to put everything on. You know what? If you wait a little longer, if you just hold off a little longer, none of your assets will matter anyhow. So if you want to hang on to your assets, be of good courage. You won't have them very much longer. If you want to use your assets, now is the time to use them. Ask God, what do you want me to do with my things? By all means, you don't want to have to walk away from a lot of assets, do you? Is that what you want to do? Do you want to walk away from a lot of assets, or do you want to invest your assets so when you walk away, you don't have anything to walk away from? One of the wealthiest Seventh-day Adventists here in the United States told me, I intend to die poor. Or the Lord will come and find me poor first. Whatever the case is, God knows what plan He has for you, what assets He gave to you, what talents you have, what skills you have, what influence you have, how much energy. Some of you have been invested all your life in God's work already, but you still have influence. Not that much energy as you did it 40 years ago, but still a lot of influence, a lot of support. You can move people. You can talk and say, brother, let's support these young people. They want to go be missionaries. Let's send them a stipend across. Let them do the work. Let them go to the front lines. You know, churches that are missionary driven, they grow like crazy. Every Seventh-day Adventist church ought to send missionaries overseas. Send your young people overseas. Send them $100, $200, $500 a month. Let them do the work that they're supposed to do. If they're willing to be a volunteer, let them go. Sponsor them. Choose ye this day whom you will serve. As we close the meeting now, I want to ask you a solemn moment. Will your decision to give everything to the Lord be followed up by action? So that everybody unmistakably knows which side you're on. I believe God is calling every one of us into full-time ministry. Every one of us. That doesn't mean I work here and give a piece of my time to the Lord. It means that whatever profession I have, whatever skill, whatever I'm doing, everything is focused on the mission of the church. That's what it is. No matter what job you do, I believe God is calling everybody to full-time ministry. One lady in Walla Walla, after I preached, said, but David, you need us here in the States to be making money so that we can give you money to do God's work. And I said, not. God already owns the money before you already earned it. You can't earn any more money. It's already God's anyhow. God needs you working for Him. And if He gives you money, use it. If He doesn't give you money, use what you got. Play the game of life with the deck of cards that you got in your hand. I'm going to pray now. And I'm going to pray that God will, in a special way, help you to follow through with decisions. That it won't just say, Lord, like that frog, I made a decision, I follow the Lord all the way, but no changes are made. That indeed, you will start, people will notice there's a difference in that person's life, that what they're doing, saying, how they live. Now is the golden moment. And the greatest victories, Sister White says, and the greatest defeats are determined on the matter of minutes. I'm going to pray now during this minute, and I hope it's the golden moment for you. Let's bow our heads. Lord Jesus, we recognize the times that we live in. We're accelerating toward the final event as all of these things, the technologies, the medicine, the terrorism, the good and the bad, all come together at the same time, Lord, and things are ready to explode. Only through your mercies the world is held off from the final events as your character is given an opportunity to be held up before the world in our lives, in our writings, in our influence, and as well as by media, so that people can see what a God of love you are, but you have to live through us. So today, this evening, this wonderful Sabbath afternoon, the seventh-day Sabbath, which you set aside for us, as we pause now, the decisions that were made, those that are being made, that we will not only make those decisions and say, who's on the Lord's side? I am. But also, I will live my life in such a way that everybody will know unmistakably that I am on the side of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. That is my prayer for everyone here, Lord. And that this next year, as we wait for another year of camp meeting, will be the most marvelous year of our experience in our life, filled with joy, filled with the success of divine seal, as we accept the commission of being special forces for you, is my prayer. In Jesus' name, amen.